Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. This is just one segment of today's show. You can hear all of our conversations about New York's vibrant cultural scene on demand at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. You're listening to Soundcheck at 93.9 WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm John Schaefer. On the program today, we have a live performance in our studios from LA's Section Quartet, a string quartet that plays the music of Radiohead. And later on, we unravel Mozart's greatest hit. But first, we take a look at a lawsuit that is having some resonance in the music community. 16 years ago, singer Tom Waits sued and won a $2.5 million lawsuit against the Frito-Lay Corporation for stealing his trademark sound. Waits said the corporation asked him to perform a song for a Doritos TV commercial, and when Waits refused, Frito-Lay hired another singer to imitate his gravelly, deep baritone voice for the advertisement. Well, last Friday, Ben Cesario, who covers music and the arts for the New York Times, published his exclusive interview with Tom Waits about the recent outcome of a new legal battle. Ben Cesario, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thanks a lot. It's a pleasure to be here.
So what was Tom Wall exercised about this time?
Well, this time there are two cases going on in Europe that are also about television commercials. And one of them was just decided by a judge. It was in Spain, and it was about a commercial for Audi, where they used not a version of his song, but sort of rewrote one of his songs and got somebody to imitate his voice. And he apparently learned about this from fans in Spain and sued.
Mm-hmm.
And won.
And received a total of $79,000.
Yeah, it was 36,000 euros for copyright infringement of the musical composition itself, but then another 30,000 euros for what was called violation of his moral rights as an artist.
All right. Moral rights as an artist, kind of a nebulous legal concept, but
right.
To me, even more nebulous is what copyright was infringed?
Well, the copyright, there are basically two legal issues in this case, and one was the copyright of the song. His song "Innocent When You Dream"
right.
was copied for this commercial, and it was just too close to his actual song. So he won a copyright infringement case over the musical composition. But the other thing was his so-called moral rights, which here in the United States are usually called the right of publicity or the right of privacy, and it's the idea that you have an identity that is yours alone, that someone can't steal for any purpose.
Right, especially for commercial purposes.
Especially for commercial purposes.
So it sounds like what they're calling copyright infringement is very close to a kind of a plagiarism suit. They're basically saying that they didn't write a new song, they just kind of sloppily rewrote an old Tom Waits tune.
Well, what the lawyer for the advertising agency in Spain said is that they wanted to do a Tom Waits type song, and so they got somebody to do an imitation or to write a new song similar to his. And this actually happens in advertising all the time.
Right.
That one of the things that advertisers want is the sense of familiarity. So they often sort of mimic a sound or a style or a person's composition, but tweak it just enough so that it's legal.
Right. So, Ben, the $79,000 award, much smaller than the $2.5 million he got for the Frito-Lay Corporation suit. Is that a function of this being Spain as opposed to the United States and a much smaller market?
I think so. I don't know if it has to do with the market as much as just the courts there. I mean, I've been told by the lawyers in the case in Spain that punitive damages for these kinds of cases in Europe just tend to be very small in comparison to the United States. So I don't think it's a matter of they don't think it's as big of a deal. I think it could be potentially a very big deal for the music industry in Europe.
All right, we're speaking with Ben Cesario, who covers music and the arts for the New York Times. And in a moment, Ben, I want to ask you the big question, which is, can a singer, even a singer with a distinctive voice like Tom Waits, really make a case for kind of owning the quality of a style of singing? But first, let's hear what all the hullabaloo has been about. We're going to compare the song from this Audi car commercial with the Tom Waits original called Innocent When You Dream. I guess we'll hear the Tom Waits original first and then from the Audi commercial. All right, Ben Cesario from the New York Times. I can certainly see, or rather hear, Tom Waits' point.
Yeah, and it's funny that in the commercial, the first words the guy says are something about packaging your dream.
Uh-huh. Now, when he sued successfully against the Frito-Lay Corporation for the Doritos ads, my understanding is that the lawsuit was based upon them using a singer who sounded like him. And so here is the question. Because you have a deep, kind of gravelly voice, does that mean that no one else can sing the way you do?
Well, it's a very slippery question, but I think the answer basically is yes. No one can purposely imitate your voice, and especially Tom Waits has a very unique and distinctive voice, and so it's easy to tell. For others, it might not, but he's actually not the only person who's done this. And another case involved Bette Midler. The Tom Waits case against Doritos was decided in 1990, and the Bette Midler case was the year before that, and that sort of established California common law about this. There was a commercial for Lincoln Mercury that used the song "Do You Want to Dance," which Bette Midler had recorded in 1971, and they actually instructed the singers in the studio when they made the commercial to do it just like Bette Midler, and that was the thing that lost them the case.
All right,
and Bette Midler, and then Tom Waits the year after that, pretty much established this as a matter of law.
And so it was a matter of intent on the part of the people making the commercial as well.
I mean, merely having a gravelly voice, you know, doesn't mean you're copying Tom Waits, because otherwise a lot of other people would be out of work.
But, Ben, when we began, you said that Tom Waits had two different lawsuits going. The one in Spain has been resolved. You said there was another one in Europe.
Yeah, there's one in Germany against Opel, which is a division of General Motors. And he sued in the middle of last year, I believe, about this. He first learned of it right about a year ago. Opel had a commercial that was running in Scandinavian countries that used basically the music of the Brahms Lullaby, and it had a very Tom Waitsian type of singer singing lines about sort of putting the car to sleep or something like that. And once he heard about it, he sued, and it turned out that they had actually asked him to perform on the commercial, and he turned them down. He turns everybody down, and I think it's pretty surprising that he gets asked all the time.
Yeah.
Even though he has a reputation going back decades now of not doing this.
Right. Well, Ben, he also doesn't do interviews, but you got to him, so congratulations on that. And Ben Cesario covers music and the arts for the New York Times. We've been talking about Tom Waits winning another one, a lawsuit in Spain against the Audi car company and the commercial, enterprise that was responsible for making the commercial. Here is the audio of the current litigation, the Opel automobile commercial. And as we listen to that, thank you, Ben, for joining us on Soundcheck today.
Thanks very much for having me.
Not Tom Waits, but in an incredible and perhaps illegal simulation. Up next on Soundcheck, the Section Quartet comes in from L.A. The String Quartet plays the music of Radiohead live in our studio, and then later we unravel Mozart's greatest hit. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and that is a little bit of Eine kleine Nachtmusik, a little night music by Mozart. We kick off a week of special programming looking at Mozart's music and legacy, and we begin with guest Robert Capello, the composer and conductor and host of the series called What Makes It Great, which he's done many times at Lincoln Center, and in this archive performance at our WNYC piano. Rob Capello telling us what makes Eine kleine Nachtmusik great. Topic number one, since this is, after all, one of the most familiar pieces of classical music ever written, is, do we really need to hear Eine kleine Nachtmusik yet again?
You know, that's a great question. And I think sometimes the people we think we know the best are the people that we actually know the least. I mean, everybody in the world has heard Eine kleine Nachtmusik. It's probably the most ubiquitous commercial television music you've ever heard. I mean, raisins, grapes, everybody has heard Eine kleine Nachtmusik on some television commercial. And yet it's actually an incredibly extraordinary piece. Sometimes when you know how a piece goes, it's like visiting the same resort all the time. You actually miss it. And this piece is truly superb. There are many letters from Mozart where he talks about having a surface that the general public could listen to and appreciate, but that there's always something beneath the surface for the connoisseur, for the cognoscenti. And nothing is more true of that than Mozart.
Mm-hmm. And even in a piece like this, which we see as kind of a lighthearted little ditty that he tossed off?
It's a masterpiece. You know, that's what makes it so incredible, is it probably was a ditty that he tossed off. But the level of genius is so high that even in an outdoor little ditty, there is a level of unbelievable genius that you can't imagine. And, I mean, even just take this famous opening. There's an opening tune here that I'm sure we've all heard a million times. It goes sort of like this. Actually, in my program, I'm going to spend 25 minutes on those 4 seconds. But just to give you a little tidbit feel, I wrote a version of this melody, a kind of like Salieri version, mm-hmm. a version like if he were really a worse composer that he might have written. And it might go something like this. I'm actually accenting in a grotesque fashion, my grotesque version. And in that version, every single bar starts with a bum bum. You've got a like a bum bum, then another one, bum bum. And you copy. Now, I'm going to make it one step better. One of the things that's great about Mozart is he never insults your intelligence. He never gives you redundant information. And there's an incredible plot that's going on musically, narrative-wise, on bum bum. So what you got here is, first, you have this. Now, I copied like this. That would be redundant information. So the first thing he does to make it better is instead of going, he goes like this. What we call an appoggiatura. And just the difference between and for Salieri might make an afternoon. I mean, that's not bad. Now, the thing is, okay, so we've got a little idea here. The difference between bum bum and appoggiatura. Now, an ordinary composer might think that was enough for an afternoon and play the whole melody using appoggiaturas. And then it would have sounded like this. And then do it again. And then again. You're nauseated by now. And then, hopefully not. But you get the idea. You've invented one thing, and for some composer, for an Intel inventor, that chip might be enough for the company for a year. But what's great about Mozart is even further the discussion proceeds, and we vary that. So you got a version that started with this. We varied this. Instead of going, we went like this. Now he says, what if I turn that into a trill? Now we've got a fantastic other possibility, which sounds, by the way, far better on the violins than me at the keyboard. So now we have another possibility. Now, you could have been a bad composer and said, great idea, trill. And every single one of these bars would have had a trill, and that would be even more nauseating than the aversion with appoggiatura. And it would have sounded like this. Trill. Another one. Another one. But what Mozart does, which is so fantastic, is he has a discussion, and you never know which is coming next. He starts with bum-bum, then does trill, then does just appoggiatura, then trill, and then just one note. So every single bar is a new piece of information. Bum-bum, trill, then appoggiatura. But it's not just an appoggiatura, it's a not trill. But it's only a not trill if you're really in there listening. So every single step of the way around every corner of Mozart's universe is a surprise. You don't know if it's going to be bum-bum. You don't know if it's going to be trill. You don't know if it's going to be an appoggiatura. But every step of the way assumes you're hanging on WNYC, barely paying attention to your car as you're driving in, mm-hmm. because you're so listening for the difference between appoggiatura and trill. Now, when we listen on a commercial, it goes by. We just listen to this melody, and it sounds as if it's regular. If you don't listen closely, you're not actually hearing the piece he wrote, but you're hearing a Salieri version because you're hearing parallels where they aren't. Now, what I can't resist is while this fantastic thing is going on, there's an unbelievable thing in the viola that took me like 5 years to notice. I got to show you this detail. A boring composer would have just had a viola line underneath this in which every single bar was the same note 8 times. So here's a boring average viola part. The melody's up here. And the viola part's down here. Here's a boring viola part. I'll bang it out. Now, that would be serviceable. It's functional. Salieri, fine. I hope there are no big Salieri fans out there. But, I mean, that's functional.
This works. Is New York. There's probably a whole Salieri society now marching down the street towards us.
But the construction workers on 45th Street, I know, are joining with the Salieri forces. But that's a boring version. But it's fine. It works. This is an outdoor piece. It didn't have to be any better than that. But instead of going like this, he hears this incredible possibility. And just listen to these few notes that change. He hears this. And then again. But if that's not spectacular enough, the 4 notes that are different, the 5 notes, are actually the same 5 notes of the melody, and they're in canon. So this little viola line that didn't have to be great, that could have been ordinary, not only changes and has variety, but makes a little canon, i.e. the first violin plays it 1 beat later. Now listen, and you'll never hear it the same. I'll do it slow, the 2 together. Viola. I mean, it's incredible. And again, you know, there's a wonderful phrase. The poet Robinson Jeffers has this phrase, and he says, he talks about things where he calls them divinely superfluous beauty. You know, it's, in other words, beauty that didn't have to happen. It's superfluous. It's unnecessary, and that's what makes it so divine. In a way, that's what this is. I mean, this was probably an outdoor serenade. He probably wrote it in a week. Probably no one even listened. Like, Satin Doll today would serve the same function at an outdoor party as this. And yet, even in the midst of this, the beauty being so superfluous, it's all that stuff. Mozart couldn't skip it. The surface of Mozart's world looks so perfect, so pristine, so elegant that you barely even notice it. Yet beneath it, it is teeming with this little moments of passion, these tiny little details that make all the difference in the world. You know, and I think that was, to me, really where these programs came from. Being humiliated that I missed it, but then astonished at what a world of emotion could be contained in the tiniest difference. You know, the difference between ordinary and genius is on one hand huge, but on the other hand, tiny.
Mm.
And it's just amazing. Everywhere you look, there's this possibility of hearing more than was there. You know, I often say that great composers are people who listen for possibilities better than us, who just hear the ordinary things and hear how rich they can become. The famous second movement tune that I think many people march down aisles to at weddings, you know, it starts like this. I mean, a very simple, beautiful tune. The opening is nothing other than three E's. I mean, you don't have to be the world's greatest genius to write three E's. But the first time Mozart harmonizes it like this, with a C underneath, the normal version, you meet the person, their corporate personality, he's exactly who you expect him to be. First time like this. The second time you meet them, you get to know them better, and suddenly there's this. The third time, at the end, there's still yet a third version. And it's so peaceful. You've had an entire journey of discovery on just three notes. Yet normally we listen to this piece and it just goes by. It's just a serenade. So that's my goal, is to just get people to hear how much more incredible these pieces are than we could ever dream.
And Robert Capello, conductor and also composer of Green Eggs and Ham. And... Before we return to the first movement, which we'll hear in its entirety of the Mozart Eine kleine Nachtmusik, is there, you want to give us a little bit more of it?
Sure. I'll give you something that will actually be the very ending. And it's something that, again, I barely even noticed until I actually was thinking about how can I get this across. Symmetry is something that we sort of assume in the classical period. But the thing that's so wonderful about Mozart is that what appears to be symmetrical is in fact not. One of the commonest ways you have symmetry in Mozart is to end a first section of a two-part piece and have the second section end the same way, a kind of musical rhyme. The first section of this piece actually ends like this. And there's a kind of bum, 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 which is so gracious and white linen and corset and wig kind of thing, a bum, bum, bum. So get that in your ear one more time. Now, anybody else would end the piece, the second half, the same way, in a different key like this. And you're expecting it. You want that symmetry. But instead of going, first he takes bum, 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 and does this. A kind of kvetch, chromatic kvetch.
Now, is that the musicological term?
Yes, that was in Mozart's manuscript, a kind of kvetch. But notice, it's not only a, if you're really listening, it's also a not. It's a, then he does it again, and you're on the edge of your seat thinking, is he going to do it now? Or is he going to do this again? Well, it's Mozart. Always new information. He does instead up. Then we think, okay, three lovely chords will end the movement. But instead you get one, and all of a sudden is it appearing in a completely new guise. That's the thing about Mozart's world. Around every step of the corner is something you never knew. Every piece of music is, in a way, a worldview. Either the world is something we expect, bum, 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 gets echoed by bum, 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 or every step of life, every day is filled with a surprise. And if you don't listen closely, Mozart almost sounds symmetrical.
All right, let's hear the first movement of Mozart's Eine kleine Nachtmusik, and let's really hear it.
Right.
Thank you.
Heard that ending as if for the first time, Robert Capello, thanks to your explication of how it's sort of brought back in a slightly different form each time.
Right, and you didn't have to pay the ticket price.
That's right. The first movement, of course, of Mozart's Eine kleine Nachtmusik, A Little Night Music. Rob Capello, conductor, composer, NPR commentator, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, John.
Our studio and at our piano. I'm John Schaefer, and this is Soundcheck. Right.
Rob Capello joined us earlier in our studio at a time when he was bringing his program called What Makes It Great to Lincoln Center, something he does on occasion. And that'll do it for today's edition of Soundcheck. Tomorrow, is the music industry a man's world? We'll look at the roles of women in the business and whether there's a glass ceiling. Our guests will include Ann Powers, an editor at Blender magazine. And of course, we carry on with Mozart 250, our celebration of Mozart, the man and his music, with conductor and author Jane Glover. She's written a new book that reveals the profound influence that women had on Mozart's music. No glass ceiling there. Soundcheck's technical director is Irene Trudell. The program is produced by Allison Lichter and Brian Wise, with help today from Simon Rentner. Our senior producer is Gisele Regatow. Our executive producer is Chris Bannon. And we had help today from Melissa Fogarty. I'm John Schaefer. Join us again at this time tomorrow for another Soundcheck here at New York Public Radio. Thanks for listening to today's podcast of Soundcheck from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This was just one of the show's segments. You can hear everything we do on demand at WNYC.org. Check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.